welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, May 8th, 2020. I'm your reader, Alan Fredericksen. Here's a look at what I'll be reading today. First, I'll take a look at the weather, then the mini editorial, then front page and inside stories of local interest. About 20 minutes after the hour, I'll read the letter to the editor and maybe an editorial. Then at 8:30, I'll read the obituaries. After that, it will be feature stories, sports, and other stories as time allows. First, here's the weather. And then the mini editorial. Well, the forecast for today is lots of sunshine, but it's still going to be cool, 57 degrees for the high. Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, cool every day. Highs 62, 55, 57, 55. Rain chances on Saturday. So going to be cold, and it's going to be really cold Sunday morning, 30 degrees. Well, here's the mini editorial, and it's from Brian Clark today from Sioux City. Brian says, there is no need to argue or yell at employees. If they request you wear a face mask, cover your coughs, stay 6 feet from others, not touch excessive things, etc. They are doing their jobs by trying to prevent other customers from getting sick and, more important, themselves. If you don't like it, then go somewhere else or just stay home. Again, that rant is from Brian Clark from Sioux City. Here's the lead story. Metro Sioux City sees deadliest day yet as 5 more patients succumb to COVID-19. Dolly Butts has this Dateline Sioux City story. Metro Sioux City had its deadliest day yet from the novel coronavirus Thursday, as Woodbury and Dakota counties combined for 5 more deaths. Woodbury, Iowa's fifth largest county, reported 3 new COVID-19 deaths, raising its total to 7. Dakota County registered 2 more deaths, increasing its tally to 5. Metro Sioux City has experienced one of the fastest rates of growth of the virus in the United States in the last 2 weeks. Dakota County, which reported 32 new cases Thursday, now is 1,046, which is third most among Nebraska's 93 counties. The number of Woodbury County cases rose by 87 Thursday to a total of 1,426. According to Siouxland District Health Department, the 3 deaths reported Thursday included a woman between 61 and 80, a man in that same age range, and a woman over 81. All 3 reportedly died at local hospitals. The Dakota County Health Department does not provide information on the gender or the age of county residents who die from the virus. In a joint statement issued Thursday, Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center and Unity Point Health St. Luke's said they are providing care for 78 COVID-19 patients. Iowa Department of Public Health data, which was last updated Wednesday, shows that a total of 506 hospital beds are available in Regional Medical Coordination Center Region 3, which includes Woodbury County and most of Northwest Iowa. Nearly all of the patients currently hospitalized with COVID-19 are being cared for in Sioux City Hospital. RMCC3, which is again that area in Northwest Iowa that it counts beds, has 46 COVID-19 patients in ICU beds, and there are still 67 beds available. The state statistics show 35 ventilators are being used by patients and an additional 51 ventilators are available in the region. Winnebago tribal health officials said Thursday that 2 new cases of COVID-19 had been confirmed on the Winnebago Indian Reservation. One individual was tested in another county and the other was tested at 12 Clans Unity Hospital in Winnebago. The gender and age of the individuals was not released. 4 cases of COVID-19 have now been reported in Winnebago. The 2 new patients have been isolated and are in good condition, according to a news release from the Winnebago Comprehensive Healthcare System, which is composed of 12 Clans Unity Hospital and the Winnebago Public Health Department. The recent uptick in cases in Woodbury and Dakota counties is linked to Dakota City's Tyson Fresh Meats plant, which employs more than 4,300 workers. As of last Thursday, 669 Tyson workers had tested positive for COVID-19, a source familiar with the situation told the Journal. The meat packer closed last Friday for cleaning. Tyson on Monday delayed the plant's reopening, which had been scheduled for Tuesday, while awaiting complete results of testing of its workers. The plant did reopen on Thursday. 3 of the 6 Metro Sioux City residents to die from the virus were Tyson workers, and a 56-year-old man who worked at the Seaboard Triumph Foods pork plant, who also died of the disease Friday. Seaboard Triumph reported last week that 11 of its workers had tested positive for the virus. A second story from the front page of the Journal is headlined, Tyson Reopens Dakota City Plant. Metro leaders offer both optimism and unease. Dateline Dakota City. Local leaders offered a mixture of optimism and unease as Tyson Fresh Meats on Thursday reopened its Dakota City plant following an outbreak of COVID-19 among its workers. Tyson idled its largest beef plant for 6 days to give it a deep cleaning and to test all of its 4,300 employees. The company refused to disclose how many workers tested positive for the virus. Those who did are not to return to duty until health officials deem them safe to do so, company officials said. Due to absenteeism, the plant is running at less than half its normal production. Tyson spokesman Liz Crosston is the one who told the Journal that on Thursday. We will gradually and carefully increase production to ensure the continued safety of our team members, their loved ones, and our community, Crosston said in an email. The employees' test results were sent to the Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services, which will then forward the data to the Dakota County Health Department. It's unclear if the new batch of test results have started showing up in the County Health Department's daily numbers. On Thursday, the department reported only 32 new cases, raising its total to 1,046. Five residents have died from the virus, including at least two Tyson workers. With a population of just 10,000, Dakota County has the third most cases among Nebraska's 93 counties and is one of the highest rates per capita in the nation. Rod Koch, mayor of neighboring South Sioux City, said Thursday he supports Tyson returning to production, having taken preventive measures he believes are sufficient to avoid further contagion among the workers. I'm glad they shut it down for the amount of time that they did. I think that gave them a chance for a deep cleaning and for everybody to get tested, Koch said Thursday. From what I've been hearing, that's enough time for any virus that could be in the plant to be eliminated. Koch said independent teams have inspected the plant to monitor workers for illness and to ensure they are social distancing. I think right now, with the changes they've made inside the plant, with the requirement of having temperatures taken when you come in every day, masks and the separation pods, I just think they've gone the extra mile to get things as safe as possible, Koch said. I don't have a problem with them coming back with everything that they've done. Anything short of that probably would not have been in support of it. State Senator Jackie Smith, a Democrat who represents a district in neighboring Sioux City, said she's uncomfortable with the level of secrecy surrounding how many workers have become infected. She resumed her call for an independent body to oversee the plant's reopening. I think it's too soon, and I don't think they've been transparent enough. It makes me very nervous, said Smith, who suggested a variety of agencies, including OSHA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and even the University of Nebraska, that might be able to independently oversee how the plant is operating. Though the plant is outside her district, Smith noted many workers live in Sioux City and may have inadvertently contributed to the virus's spread in Woodbury County, which has also experienced a rapid increase in COVID-19 infection. As of Thursday, Iowa's fifth largest county had 1,426 positive tests and 7 deaths. Sioux City Mayor Bob Scott suggested Tyson may have felt compelled to reopen by President Donald Trump's executive order last week, requiring meat packers to keep operating under provisions of the Defense Production Act. I don't think they have a lot of options. I mean, the president ordered it, number one. Number two, hopefully they've learned quite a bit and they've got their plant cleaned up and probably have done some things to socially distance their employees, Scott said. I'm sure they have. As of April 30, at least 669 workers had tested positive for the virus, according to a source who spoke to the Journal on the condition of anonymity. Scott suggested workers may now be resistant to the virus, though scientific evidence of acquired COVID-19 immunity has, to date, been rather spotty in the absence of clear data. A lot of people have, unfortunately, been affected by this, and they say that if you have, you have more resistance to it, Scott said. So I think that in and of itself will probably help a lot to stop the spread. The third local story from the front page of the Journal is headlined, UFCW calls for COVID-19 tests for all essential workers it represents in Metro Sioux City. Dateline Dakota City, Dave Driesen has this story. With COVID-19 tests for all Tyson Fresh Meats employees in Dakota City completed, United Food and Commercial Workers Local 222 called Thursday for Iowa and Nebraska to test all other essential workers the union represents in Metro Sioux City. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to implement universal testing at every workplace we represent, the union said in a statement. Every member of Local 222 is critical to our community and our nation, surviving and thriving during this pandemic. In Nebraska, they include the food workers at Empirical Foods, and in Iowa, they include food workers at Jalita, Seaboard Triumph Foods, and Darling, as well as healthcare workers at Mercy One Siouxland. Together with these companies, we've been working hard to obtain coronavirus testing for all of our members who play such essential roles and give them the testing they need to help to keep themselves safe. There coworkers and their families, too. It's long past time for governors of Iowa and Nebraska to fully commit to universal testing for all our essential workers. The Tyson Dakota City plant, easily the metro area's largest employer, reopened Thursday following a six-day pause. The meat giant shut down its largest beef plant to give it a deep cleaning and to test its entire 4,300-member workforce. There is no measure not worth taking to protect these workers, and we believe that companies like Tyson, along with our state and local governments and the federal governments, all have a role in ensuring safety, the union said in a statement. That's why we've worked hard with our employers and state and local governments to ensure that there are critical safety measures in place, like universal testing for all employees. It's a critical measure to make sure that these workplaces are as safe as possible, and thanks in part to the commitment of the state of Nebraska, it happened in Dakota City. At least four Dakota City workers have died of COVID-19, and nearly 700 others had tested positive for the virus as of late last week. Local 222 also represents unionized food processing at the Seaboard Triumph Foods pork plant, where at least one worker has died of COVID-19. The plant, Sioux City's largest employer, employs about 2,400 workers. Mayor Bob Scott backed the UFCW's request during a news conference at his office Thursday. The mayor cited the unionized nurses and other employees at Mercy One Siouxland, where dozens of COVID-19 patients have been hospitalized in the last week. If I was working in a hospital right now, I think they have an obligation as a hospital, and they have an obligation as employees of the hospital to be tested, Scott said, because they may not even be working in a department where they are taking care of people with that coronavirus, but it's still terribly important to make sure they're not spreading it in the hospital. And I know they take all the precautions they can, all of those things, but it's just going to happen. I think the union's right on that. Now turning to page A3 inside the journal, the headline reads, Bob Scott asks Sioux Citians to delay shopping as Reynolds order allows retailers to reopen. Dateline Sioux City. As some Sioux City stores prepared to reopen Friday, Mayor Bob Scott urged local residents to consider curtailing shopping trips, citing the metro area's high rate of COVID-19 cases. I would just tell those citizens, do what I'm probably going to do. You don't have to go there right away, Scott said at a news conference Thursday. I'm not going to run out and go shopping tomorrow because the stores are opening. I'm just not going to do that. I don't think it's the right thing for me to do. Starting Friday, shoppers can return to non-essential retail outlets in Sioux City under an order signed late Wednesday by Governor Kim Reynolds. The governor's latest emergency order relaxes COVID-19 mitigation strategies in 22 counties, including Woodbury, where the novel coronavirus is more widespread. In those 22 counties, malls and other stores may reopen Friday if they operate at no more than 50% capacity. Dine-in service in bars and restaurants in the 22 counties remain prohibited until at least May 15. Those establishments have been limited to drive-through, carry-out, or delivery services. The state's relaxing of the retail restrictions comes as Woodbury and neighboring Dakota County, Nebraska, continue to experience one of the nation's fastest COVID-19 growth rate. Much of the spread has been attributed to the Tyson Fresh Meats beef plant in Dakota City. The plant reopened Thursday after being idled for 6 days for the company to clean its largest beef facility and test the remainder of the 4,300 workers. My fear is that we could escalate if we open up the city way too fast. But again, I think people have learned to socially distance, Scott said. I think people have learned to be safe out in the community. Scott said he would defer to Reynolds' judgment in allowing a measured reopening and suggested the governor must know more than he does about the situation. Listen, the governor has a lot more data than I have, obviously, and the governor, that's her job right now, the mayor said. The legislature gave her that power, so she's got to decide what's best for these communities, he said. And I'm not going to second guess her because I have no idea what information she has. The mayor's comments came as a number of non-essential retailers said they would remain closed or limit service to pickup or curbside delivery. The Southern Hills Mall, which has been closed since March 23rd, has no plans to reopen on Friday, a spokesman for the mall's owner said. Shields, a sporting goods retailer deemed an essential business by the state, is the only store currently open at Southern Hills Mall. Sioux City's only indoor shopping center closed its common areas on March 23rd. Under Reynolds' order, malls that reopen would be required to keep children's play areas closed. As soon as we have a plan, we'll get the information out to everybody. It definitely won't be this weekend, though, the mall's marketing director, James Clarkley, said in an email Thursday. We plan to give tenants a 6-day notice. With that timeline, the earliest we would be looking at for a reopen would be Wednesday, May 13th. Shields is the only store at the mall still open, as I just said. The state deems the sporting goods retailer an essential business, also just said that. As an anchor at the mall, it also has a separate entrance. Last week, Reynolds allowed restaurants, retailers, and some other businesses to reopen in the 77 Iowa counties where there are fewer virus cases, including Plymouth, which borders Woodbury to the north. Of the 22 counties with more strict state restrictions, Woodbury is the only one west of Interstate 35. Under her emergency order signed Thursday, dentists statewide also can resume providing cleanings and other routine services on Friday. Campgrounds, drive-in movie theaters, tanning facilities, and medical spas also can reopen statewide Friday. Woodbury County Conservation announced Thursday that its campgrounds would remain closed. All reopening businesses must still practice social distancing among its staff and customers, according to the governor's orders. For example, dentists must have adequate supplies of protective equipment and comply with virus-related policies recently adopted by the State Dental Board. Campgrounds must ensure social distancing and increased hygiene practice, and cars at drive-in theaters must park 6 feet apart. Sad story here from Mason Doctor. A longtime Sioux City Asian community figure dies of COVID-19 complications. Hong Ku Di Nguyen, a longtime figure in Sioux City's Asian communities, died Wednesday of complications of COVID-19 at Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center. She was 87. Twen Tran, who had been friends with Nguyen for many years, said she had been in fragile health for some time prior to her death. She had observed social distancing recommendations and avoided unnecessary social interactions, but nonetheless contracted the virus. She knew with her age and with her condition, she knew if she caught the virus, she'd be gone, Tran said. Nguyen began experiencing symptoms of the virus earlier this week. Nguyen was born April 11, 1933, and grew up in Bentre, a community about 50 miles south of Saigon. During her teen years at Gia Long Lemire de Villers High School in Saigon, she started training for a career as a teacher at the elementary level. In my country, the teacher is not only respected by the student, she is respected as a member of the community, Nguyen told the Journal in 2005 when she was 72 years old. She earned a bachelor's degree in literature from the University of Saigon in 1966. Around that same time, Nguyen worked at the Ministry of Education and the Southeast Asian Ministries of South Vietnam. Her first visit to the United States was in 1973, when she worked on her master's degree in education from Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana. She then returned to Vietnam and was awarded a doctorate degree. When Saigon fell to the communists in 1975, Nguyen was in Malaysia working for the Southeast Ministries of Education, focusing on innovative ways to teach science and math. Nguyen applied to immigrate to the U.S. as a refugee. She was told the government's first priority would be the Boat People refugees, which she was not one of. In May of 1981, Nguyen was notified that she would be able to immigrate to the U.S., and shortly thereafter, she arrived in Boulder, Colorado. She then went to work at the Bilingual Center at the University of Iowa until 1987. She came to Sioux City in 1991. In Sioux City, she worked with agencies including the Mary J. Tralia Community House and Lutheran Social Services. Among a variety of other activities, Nguyen provided translating services and acted as a mentor, social worker, teacher, and a notary public. It's very rewarding work, Nguyen told the Journal 15 years ago. I just returned from a trip to California, and I had 33 messages on my answering machine. Jerry McGill, who hired Nguyen at Lutheran Social Services in the early 1990s, said Nguyen had a variety of skills, including fluency in multiple languages. Her first language was French, which she learned and she learned Vietnamese from her parents. English was a language she decided to learn just for fun, Nguyen told the Journal in 2005. At Lutheran Social Services, Nguyen worked in refugee resettlement to help resettle refugees from Vietnam, Africa, and Bosnia, and did in-home counseling for families with problems due to cultural differences. I know that she loved her work. When she called me not too long ago, she said it was really the golden years of all of her work life, Miguel said Nguyen's work with the refugees, just a tremendous gift of relationships with people. People had so much respect for her. Earlier this year, when Nguyen was hospitalized for an unrelated ailment, a vast number of well-wishers came to see her. The nurse at the hospital, he asked me, "Who is she?" Tran recalled. He said, "I've worked here all these years, and I never, ever see a patient that has that many visitors. In recognition of her many years serving the community, in 2016, Nguyen was recognized by the Celebrating Community Project with a bust depicting her. In 2019, she was recognized with a Woman of Excellence Award. She is a woman who saw the good in every person that she had ever met, and the late George Young Siavong, who spoke at the ceremony in 2016, said, "She was born to serve." Laura Lee, another longtime friend of Nguyen's, recalled learning a great deal from her and described her as a force to be reckoned with. "I thought she was just amazing," Lee said. "Whatever people needed, she tried to assist them in achieving or accessing, and if she couldn't provide it, she would be a conduit for people that she was working with," she added. Again, reading from page A3 inside the journal, the headline reads, "Injunction issued against Orange City man accused of price gouging on toilet paper and cleaning products." Nick Heitrich has this Dateline Orange City story. A judge has ordered an Orange City man to stop selling toilet paper, cleaning products, and other items of need during the coronavirus pandemic for excessive prices. District Judge Patrick Tott granted a stipulated temporary injunction against Michael Notaboom, whom the Iowa Attorney General's office had accused of selling a 12-pack of Bounty paper towels for $119.99 on an eBay account known as MN65. Other items selling so far above the retail value included a 12-ounce can of Lysol disinfectant spray for $65.99 and a 12-roll pack of Angel Soft toilet paper for $86. The state alleged that from March 2nd to March 27th, Notaboom sold 272 items that were often hard to find in stores because of shortages caused by COVID-19 hoarding. He sold these on eBay above market cost to buyers across the country. Notaboom, 52, agreed to the injunction but denied the allegations or that he had violated Iowa's Consumer Fraud Act, according to the order issued Wednesday in Sioux County District Court. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds on March 9th issued a disaster declaration, triggering the state's price gouging rule, which forbids charging excessive prices for goods or services needed by disaster victims. The Attorney General's office received two complaints against Notaboom. Under the terms of the stipulated temporary injunction, Notaboom may not buy or sell toilet paper towels, wipes, disinfecting or sanitizing products, as well as masks, gloves, water, food, medical supplies, or other goods needed by the victims during the pandemic on any online sales platform, such as eBay. He may buy those items for personal use, however. The temporary injunction will remain in effect for the duration of any national or state COVID-19-related emergency declaration and for a six-month recovery period after those declarations are lifted. If a new disaster declaration is issued after the six-month period, terms of the injunction shall again be applied for the duration of the new declaration plus 6 months. If Notaboom violates the temporary injunction, a judge could convert it to a permanent injunction. As part of the stipulated agreement, the state will not seek any civil penalties as part of the injunction, but could still seek fines and/or restitution under the Consumer Fraud Act. Violators are subject to civil penalties of up to $40,000. Attorney General spokesman Lynn Hicks said that although Notaboom's alleged activities took place on an online auction site in which buyers agreed to pay top prices through a bidding process, those sites still are subject to the price gouging statutes. The key things we look at are, is the item considered necessary as a disaster item, and is it an excessive price? It doesn't matter where it's sold or how a consumer agrees to pay for it, Hicks said. The lawsuit against Notaboom was the first Iowa price gouging petition filed during the COVID-19 pandemic. Since the beginning of the public health emergency, the Attorney General's Consumer Protection Division has received more than 470 reports of price gouging. Consumers may learn more about price gouging or file complaints at the Attorney General's website, www.iowaattorneygeneral.com. Consumers can also contact the Consumer Protection Division by phone at 888-777-4590 or by email at consumer@ag.iowa.gov. Finally, before we go to the obituaries, this story comes to us again. Park facilities, campgrounds in Woodbury County and Sioux City are to remain closed. Park facilities and campgrounds in Woodbury County and Sioux City will remain closed until at least May 15th, despite Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds' order this week allowing parks and other establishments to begin reopening. Woodbury County Conservation Board Dan Heisel announced in a press release Thursday that all Woodbury County Conservation Board facilities, including campgrounds, will remain closed through May 15th due to the COVID-19 outbreak. "It's the right thing to do at this time," Heisel said in the statement. Woodbury County is still one of the biggest hot spots in the state, with the third highest number of COVID-19 cases. "We are concerned about the health and safety of our community. We will continue to assess the situation and communicate with the Siouxland District Health Department. Campgrounds, rental cabins, enclosed shelters, restrooms, and playgrounds run by the Woodbury County Conservation Board will remain off limits, as will the Conservation Board's park offices in the Dorothy Pico Nature Center. Impacted parks in the county include Snyder Bend and Bigelow Park, Browns Lake near Salix, the Little Sioux Park near Correctionville, the Southwood Conservation Area, and Fowler Forest Preserve near Smithland, Midway Park near Mobile, and the Dorothy Pico Nature Center in Sioux City. Woodbury County park areas, wildlife areas, trails, boat ramps, and the Stubb Gray Shooting Range at Little Sioux Park will remain open for public use, such as hiking, fishing, hunting, bird watching, and general recreation. Public recreation facilities in Sioux City, which closed at the beginning of April, will likewise remain closed through at least May 15th. City Hall will also remain closed to the general public. City parks and trails themselves continue to be open for public use, but amenities like public playgrounds, tennis courts, skate parks, dog parks, basketball hoops, restrooms, and shelters remain closed. Park visitors are encouraged to continue to practice social distancing of at least 6 feet and avoid groups of more than 10. You're listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, May 8th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. The first is from Sioux City, Patricia Knutson, actually from Centerville, South Dakota. Patricia Knutson, 71, of Centerville, died Wednesday, May 6th at Avera McKinnon Hospital in Sioux Falls. Due to the COVID-19 related gathering and restrictions, Patty's family will have a private burial now and will host a celebration of life service at a later date to properly celebrate her life with her family and friends. Arrangements are under the direction of Wass Funeral Home in Beresford, South Dakota, and condolences may be left on its website. Thank you to her comfort keepers, Kim, who took her for rides in the country, and to the staff at Touchmark. Blessed be her memory. And from Sioux City this time, Dorothy Butler Smith, 90, of Sioux City, passed away peacefully on May 3rd, surrounded by her family. Private graveside services will be at a later date in Pleasant View Cemetery in Carthage, South Dakota. Arrangements under the direction of Morningside Chapel, Christy Smith Funeral Home. Dorothy was born on February 12, 1930, in Atchison, Kansas, to Sumner and Vivian Butler. She attended school in Atchison County. She moved to Kansas City, Missouri after high school and attended business school and worked for the Atomic Energy Commission. She later attended Manhattan Bible College. Upon completion, she attended Dakota Bible College in Huron, South Dakota. She was attending church in Carthage, South Dakota, when she met her husband, Thomas Smith. They married in Farmington, Kansas in 1954. After spending the early years of their marriage in the Black Hills and Washington State, they returned to Carthage to farm and to raise their four sons. She and her husband moved to Sioux City in 2010 to reside with their son and his family. They remained together until Tom's passing in 2016. While living in Carthage, Dorothy was involved in many community projects, including the planning and construction of the Carthage Straw Bale Museum. She served as president of the American Legion Auxiliary, taught Sunday school, played piano, and led song services at the Church of the Nazarene, as well as led Bible studies in her home. She had numerous talents, including making beautiful quilts, knitting, gardening, painting, and she was a terrific cook. She was an avid reader and enjoyed caring for numerous stray cats. She had an appreciation for her ancestry. She was proud to be a great-granddaughter of Reverend Hardy Butler, a renowned abolitionist in Kansas who helped with the Underground Railroad during the 1860s. And from Sioux City, Daniel Armstrong Sr., 72, died May 5th due to COVID-19 restrictions. A private family services will be held by Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Akron. Burial will be in Omaha Valley Cemetery in Homer, Nebraska. Visitation will be May 10th, 2-5 at the 2-5 p.m. at the funeral home. And here are more death notices from Ponca, Nebraska. Alan Quinn Fromm, F-R-A-H-M, 71, died Wednesday, May 6th, There will be a private burial in Silver Ridge Cemetery at Ponca. Moore Funeral Home of Ponca is in charge. From Sioux City, Rita Haack, H-A-A-C-K, formerly of Lamar's and age 93 of Sioux City, passed away Tuesday, May 5th at her winter home in Santan Valley, Arizona. Due to state and federal guidance on gatherings due to COVID-19 pandemic, the family will have a memorial service at a later date. Burial will be in Calvary Cemetery in Lamar's. Arrangements are under the direction of Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Lamar's, and expressions of sympathy may be left on its website. Rita Mae Kemp was born on July 10, 1926, in Owens, Iowa, the daughter of Joseph J. Kemp and Lena Reinhardt Kemp. Rita attended St. Catherine's School in Owens. She married Earl B. Haack in Lamar's on May 14, 1946. Earl was born and raised in Remsen, Iowa, until he joined the U.S. Navy. After their wedding, they made their home in Lamar's. They were happily married for 59 years when Earl passed away from cancer on January 31, 2005. Rita loved playing cards. She had many friends from church that she got together with weekly. After breaking both hips within 3 months, her card playing continued at her home while she recuperated. She had wonderful friends that came at least once a week to make sure she got her fill of pinochle. A special thanks to Rita Wiederholt, Betty Pluger, Mary Campbell, and Marlis Harms. Rita enjoyed these get-togethers. Rita stayed in her home in Lamar's until the year of her 90th birthday, and then moved to Sioux City to live with her son, Tom and Kathy Haack. She then also would winter in Arizona with family. Rita was always ready for a game of cards and had a cup of coffee sitting next to her at the kitchen table. Some memories of Mom that will stay with us forever will be her canning sweet corn, fresh tomatoes, and peaches. Among our favorite treats were her famous chocolate brownies and rhubarb pie. We will miss her tremendously, but we know how ready she was to be with Dad and all of her family. From Fort Lauderdale, Florida, but formerly from Sioux City, Karen Lynn Scott Stearns, 79, of Fort Lauderdale, formerly of Sioux City, passed away Thursday, April 23rd, in Hollywood, Florida. A celebration of life will be planned for a later date. Born on December 6, 1940, to Ray and Bonnie Davis in Sioux City, Karen graduated from Central High School, which was the castle on the hill. She would wed Bert Lynn Scott on October 2, 1959. To this union, 4 children were born: Terry, Cheryl, Jeffrey, and Timothy. Bert passed away on June 30, 2009. Karen then married Phil Stearns in 2011, and the two relocated to Fort Lauderdale. From Anthon, Iowa, Eunice Claus, C-L-A-U-S-E. She's 86, and she died Wednesday, May 6th. Memorial services will be held at a later date. Burial will be in Oak Hill Cemetery in Anthon. Armstrong Van Houten Funeral Home of Anthon is in charge. And from Sioux City, Diane J. Conrad, 64, died Thursday, May 7th. Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel is in charge. From Ramsey, Minnesota, but formerly of Akron, Iowa, Harold Dowling, 76, died Thursday, April 30th. His celebration of life will be held at a later date in Act. We have one letter to the editor this morning, and it's from Marv Huseman of Orange City, who says, "Thank you, Leonard Pitts. In 18 years of getting the Sioux City Journal, I rarely agree with the political opinions of Leonard Pitts, Jr. A number of years ago, I castigated him for comparing some of the government policies at the time with those in Nazi Germany. But for his opinion column in the Journal of May 5th, I want to commend him. It was with surprise and pleasure that I agreed with his take on the sad situation of today's dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic." That again from Marv Huseman of Orange City. Again, another story from the inside of the Journal. The Catholic Globe newspaper will be replaced by a new publication called The Lumen, L-U-M-E-N. After a 67-year history of providing Catholic news in print, the Catholic Globe is being discontinued after its May 21st edition. The publication will be replaced by a print publication called The Lumen, starting June 4th, according to media director and editor Don Prosser. "Lumen is Latin for light," Prosser said in a statement. "The name better represents who we are, our efforts, and our mission to enlighten the faithful of Northwest Iowa." Lumen Media will also offer 2 new electronic newsletters beginning in June. Lumen Notes and Notus Lumen, published in English and Spanish respectively, will be sent to people on their phones, tablets, or computers. Both Lumen Notes and Notus Lumes will be free of charge to anyone who wants to receive them. They will supplement the newspaper, not replace it. In addition, Lumen Media will continue to utilize social media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for more immediate announcements. These will be published in both Spanish and English. We realize in our diverse diocese that we simply can't offer a one-size-fits-all communications platform for all households and every Catholic in Northwest Iowa, Prosser said. Each demographic consumes their news differently, and we have to change to best meet their needs. With different products, we can work to best serve the faithful of Northwest Iowa. Reverend R. Walker Nicholas will remain publisher for both the Lumen and the Lumen Media Office. The Gavin's Point Dam releases will be reduced as the runoff slows. Nick Heitrich has this Dateline Omaha story, but of course, the dam is up in Yankton. With below normal levels of precipitation falling across portions of the Missouri River Basin so far in 2020, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers announced it will slightly reduce the amount of water flowing through Gavin's Point Dam. Releases on Friday will be decreased to 33,000 cubic feet per second, down from 35,000 cubic feet per second. Corps also reduced its 2020 forecast for runoff into the Missouri River at 32.2 million acre feet, down from last month's forecast of 35.5 million acre feet. Since January, precipitation in the upper basin has been below normal, the Corps said. Some areas of the Dakotas received less than half of their normal precipitation during the first 4 months of the year. This is still an above average runoff forecast. The upper basin runoff for the remainder of 2020 depends on how mountain snow melt and rain events. John Remus said this, who is the chief of the Corps Missouri River Basin Water Management Division, and that was in his news release. Despite the reduced forecast, 2020 projected runoff would still rank in the top 25% of the 122 years of records. The annual average annual runoff is only 25.8 million acre feet. Soil moisture conditions continue to be wet in much of the upper Missouri River Basin, which increases the potential for above average runoff. Flooding also remains a threat, particularly downstream of Sioux City, because of continued high river stages on many of the tributaries downstream from Gavin's Point. As of May 4th, storage in the six Missouri River reservoirs totaled 58.7 million acre feet, up two-tenths of a million acre feet since April 1st, and occupying 2.6 million acre feet of the 16.3 million acre feet flood control zone. And the Sioux County Sheriff's Office is seeking information about a theft of lambs, Dateline Sioux Center. The Sioux County Sheriff's Office is investigating the theft of nine feeder lambs from a farm 3 miles west of Sioux Center. According to a statement from the sheriff's office, the theft was reported at 2:57 p.m. Tuesday. The lambs have an approximate value of $500 and were taken at various times during the week prior to May 4th. Anyone with information about the crime is asked to contact the Sioux County Sheriff's Office at 712-737-2280. Another brief story from Inside the Journal is that the Sioux City facilities will remain closed. The City of Sioux City said in a statement Thursday that city facilities, including City Hall, offices, and park facilities, will remain closed to the general public until further notice. The statement, which was released after Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds issued her proclamation to reopen the businesses, said conditions will be reviewed on May 15th. The city remains fully operational, and staff may be reached by phone or email, according to the statement. And a man pleads not guilty to stabbing his mother. A South Carolina man pleaded not guilty to fatally stabbing his mother during a gathering in a Sioux City apartment. Paul Belk, 30, of Beaufort, South Carolina, entered his written plea Thursday in Woodbury County District Court to charges of first-degree murder, willful injury, and possession of a controlled substance. District Judge Jeffrey Neary scheduled trial for August 4th. Belk remains in the Woodbury County Jail on a $500,000 bond. Belk is accused of stabbing Lisa Belk, 55, in an apartment at 3811 Peters Avenue on April 14th. He is also accused of injuring his sister. According to court documents, Belk became upset with his sister and mother during a family gathering, retrieved a knife from the kitchen, and then lunged at his mother 3 times with the knife. then slashed his 28-year-old sister in the shoulder. Lisa Belk was taken to Mercy One Medical Center and died of her injuries. The sister was treated for her injuries and released. If found guilty of first-degree murder, Belk would be facing a mandatory sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. And a Sioux City man has been sentenced to 15 years in prison. Dateline to Mars. A Sioux City man has been sentenced to 15 years in prison for possession of methamphetamine and driving while under the influence of the drug. Gary Daly, 29, was sentenced in the Plymouth County District Court after pleading guilty to third offense operating while intoxicated. His probation for a 2018 conviction of possession of a controlled substance was revoked, and the original 10-year prison sentence was imposed and added to the 5-year sentence for OWI. Daly was stopped by Lamar's police on February 24th and admitted to officers he had smoked meth an hour before they pulled him over. In January 2018, he was arrested after police found methamphetamine in his vehicle during a traffic stop. And a woman has sued the Hard Rock Casino for including jalapenos in her food. Dateline Sioux City. A patron of the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino Sioux City restaurant has sued the casino because she said the restaurant staff did not warn her that her meal included jalapeno peppers. Rochelle McCoy of Sioux City says in the lawsuit that she was served a meal that had a meat mixture including jalapenos, though she had informed restaurant staff she was allergic to them. According to the lawsuit, McCoy had an allergic reaction after eating the food and had to be hospitalized for swelling, physical distress, shortness of breath, and inability to talk and near fainting. She is seeking a judgment to compensate her for her damages and medical expenses in excess of $10,000. Mike Adams, Hard Rock's vice president of operations, said the company does not comment on pending litigation. In the lawsuit filed Monday in Woodbury County District Court, McCoy said she was dining in one of the casino's restaurants on late May 7th or 8th, 2018. While ordering, she told staff she was allergic to jalapenos. Despite providing that information, she said the meat in her meal contained jalapenos and caused her to have the reaction we just described. McCoy is alleging that a Hard Rock failed to disclose the menu item contained jalapenos and that the restaurant staff was negligent by not heeding her warnings and instructions. Turning now to the sports page, the Hawkeyes attract a Husker legacy. His father earned 2 national championship rings playing wingback for Nebraska, but Iowa's latest football commitment wants to create a legacy of his own. Keegan Johnson, a wide receiver who scored a pair of touchdowns for Bellevue West in its Nebraska Class A state championship shutout of Omaha Westside, announced Wednesday he had selected the Hawkeyes from a final group of 3 that included Nebraska, and Kansas State. I spent many nights praying about this decision. I'm blessed to be in the position I'm in today, Johnson wrote in divulging his choice on Twitter. I want to thank my family, coaches, and teammates. Without you guys, this isn't possible. With that being said, I'm committed to the University of Iowa. Johnson, 6'1" and 188 pounds, is the 15th player to make a verbal commitment to be part of the Hawkeyes' 2021 football recruiting class, and the 3rd receiver to announce intentions to play for Iowa in the last 8 days. His father, Clester, earned honorable mention All-Big 8 honors as a senior in 1995 and was a member of the Cornhuskers teams, which won a national championship in both 1994 and 95. Keegan Johnson told the Omaha World-Herald that his father gave him space to reach his own decision from a collection of 8 scholarship offers that included Iowa State, North Dakota State, Northern Illinois, South Dakota State, and Wyoming, in addition to his final 3. I'm blessed that I can start my own legacy and I don't have to follow his footsteps, Johnson said. He has always preached that to me. Johnson is the 3rd son of Clester Johnson to earn a college football scholarship. His brother CJ played at Wyoming, catching 3 passes for 22 yards in a loss at Iowa in 2017. And his brother Cade will be a senior at South Dakota State this fall after earning All-American honors last season. After playing primarily as a defensive back as a sophomore, Keegan Johnson caught 52 passes for 672 yards and 8 touchdowns last season for a Bellevue West team which finished its season 13-0 with a 35-0 win over Omaha Westside last November at Memorial Stadium in Lincoln. In that game, he caught 4 passes for 66 yards and 1 score and rushed for a 50-yard touchdown. Ranked by Rivals and 24/7 Sports as a 3-star prospect on a 5-star scale, Johnson was ranked by 24/7 Sports also as the second-best prospect in Nebraska in the class of 2021. He said the stability within Iowa's coaching staff and recent growth within the Hawkeye receiving corps with Kelton Copeland as the position coach made the deciding differences in his final choice. It came down to Coach Copeland. He has changed the wide receivers at Iowa the last couple of years dramatically, Johnson said. I see myself excelling at that program and playing at a high level there. Johnson's commitment follows the same last week from receivers Arlen Bruce IV of Olathe, Kansas, and Brody Brecht of Ankeny, Iowa, part of a collection of 7 players to announce plans to be part of Iowa's 2021 recruiting class, all since April 14. They are a part of a 15-recruit class, which is now ranked 6th nationally by Rivals.com. And for you hockey fans, the Sioux City Musketeers have addressed immediate needs in the United States Hockey League Phase 2 draft. After a 16-24 record in the 2019-2020 season, the Sioux City Musketeers had a few holes to fill going into the 2 phases of the USHL draft this past week. Phase 1 was held on Monday, and Phase 2, which fills more immediate needs, happened on Tuesday. The 2 biggest areas of Musketeers coach Luke Strand wanted to address were 2 of the biggest keys for the ice for any team: more scoring and better play on the blue line. Sioux City scored the third fewest goals in the USHL last season and allowed the 7th most goals in the 16-team league. Because of some deadline deals, the Musketeers had 3 picks in the first round and checked some major needs off the list right away, even with moving back a spot in the draft. Sioux City worked out a trade with Tri-City and moved back from number 2 to number 3, but still ended up with the player Strand targeted, center Matteo Constantini. Then Sioux City added 2 defensemen, Daniel Lotch and Mike Adamson, with the next 2 picks. The Musketeers ended the draft with 19 picks, and Strand was satisfied with how the process played out. And that does it for the reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, May 8th, 2020. I've been your reader, Alan Frederick-Yell, and you can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Scientists studying the jet stream over Europe discovered that it has contributed to the extreme weather seen across the continent in the last 50 years. Jet streams are rivers of wind, 5 to 9 miles up in the high atmosphere. They're caused by solar radiation heating rising air, which is then deflected sideways by Earth's rotation. These can move up to 275 miles an hour and are strong enough to push weather around and carry moisture, dust, or volcanic ash across oceans. There are 4 jet streams on Earth, a polar and subtropical jet in both the northern and southern hemispheres, and their paths can fluctuate. When they drift toward the pole, they pull warmer air with them, causing hot summers and droughts in the middle of continents and rain in the subtropics. When they drift toward the equator, they pull cold air from the pole, causing harsher winters in the mid-continent. Scientists in Europe studied tree rings in the UK and the Mediterranean to analyze patterns of temperature and rain. They found that, since 1960, the northern polar jet had drifted more frequently than in any period in the last 300 years, bringing droughts to the south and floods to the west in some years, and the opposite the next. Climatologists theorize that a generally warming planet may be influencing the path of the jet stream. But most scientists agree that we really don't know the cause. It's one more of those big mysteries blowing around right here on Earth. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.
This is Tom Hatton with an Irish short take from the book entitled A Culinary History of Iowa. And this article, actually it says chapter 2, is entitled Immigrants Influence Iowa's Food Traditions. Hundreds of thousands of pioneers and immigrants from many parts of Europe and beyond flocked to Iowa in the 19th and early 20th centuries in search of a better life, whether that meant economic opportunity, religious freedom, or the chance to create a utopian society. These newcomers brought a variety of unique food traditions with them and transformed Iowa's culinary history. Some immigrants, like the French Icarians, were motivated by ideological ideals when they settled in America. The new state of Iowa, specifically Adams County, became the promised land for French men and women pursuing their dream to create a communal utopian society where everyone was equal. By some accounts, their Icaria colony in southwest Iowa was the longest existing non-religious, purely communal experiment in American history. The first Icarian party arrived in Iowa in 1852. They purchased about 3,000 acres of land from the United States government at $1.25 per acre to build their new colony near Corning. Living conditions in the untamed lands of southwest Iowa were often harsh. Log houses, some without wood floors or windows, were the French settlers' only shelter against the brutal winter. Most of the Icarians' land was unfenced, unbroken prairie, and there was not one settler along the trail before they reached Icaria, according to some reports. Supplies for the colony often had to be hauled overland for hundreds of miles. Only a few basic ingredients, including milk, butter, cornbread, and bacon, formed the daily menu. As a communal society, the Icarians worked together on the farms and ate together in a communal dining hall, where evening meals were sometimes followed by music or lectures, spoken in French. Little by little, living conditions in the colony improved as the Icarians managed to establish a fairly successful agricultural enterprise. When wool prices skyrocketed with the outbreak of the Civil War, the Icarians thrived by selling wool and other supplies to the Union Army. While the war ended in 1865, trouble was brewing in the Icaria colony by the 1870s. Much of the conflict revolved around Little Gardens, according to an April 1921 article in the Iowa History Journal, The Pelham Pest. Earlier in the history of the Icarian community in Iowa, each family had been permitted to cultivate a little garden around their log house where flowers might be raised. Some families had planted vines and even fruit trees. Now that these plants were bearing fruit, the more radical members of the colony could not tolerate this violation of their rules against private property. The possessors of the gardens, however, clung to their little plots of ground. It wasn't much, but it was theirs. The authorities tried to settle the quarrel with a compromise. As each family moved from their log house to a new frame house, their little garden was to be given up. There would be no simple resolution to this dispute, however, which triggered open hostilities. The radicals claimed that the community had violated its constitution and announced their intent to withdraw. They also advocated an aggressive style of communism and appealed to a circuit court to revoke the charter granted to the community in 1860 on the grounds that Icaria was really a communist establishment instead of an agricultural society, as the Articles of Incorporation provided. By 1879, a group of younger progressive colony members had split from the older, more conservative members. This marked the beginning of the end for the Icarians' utopian experiment in Iowa. In 1898, members voted to end the colony. By then, it consisted mostly of elders who could no longer continue the hard work of operating the colony. The Icarian movement in America was over. The legacy of the Icarian movement endures, however. The French Icarian Colony Board of Trustees was formed in recent years and has been rebuilding the French Icarian village on a portion of original Icarian land east of Corning. The 1878 refectory, communal dining hall, and 1860 one-room Icaria school have been restored for tours and research. History comes to life at the French Icarian village through events like the annual Fête de Mai, Festival of Corn, which is held in the fall. The original Fête de Mai was a celebration held by the Icarians each fall after all the crops were harvested. The feast was served in the communal dining hall to everyone who came to help on the final day of corn harvest. In late September 2015, the Creston News Advertiser promoted the French Icarian village's fourth annual Fête de Mai, which included a four-course French supper featuring flavors of the Alsace region. It's a modern taste of the French Icarian's quest for utopia in Iowa. And that was an excerpt from A Culinary History of Iowa by Darcy Doherty Malsey, and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.